go to thecognitiverampage.com. Feel free to contribute, donate, keep fueling the change, whatever it is that you guys can do to help continue to allow this to happen. None of this would happen without you and your love and your support and, of course, your contributions. Love you.
Welcome to Cognitive Rampage Podcast. Hope you're taking care of you. Hope you're living your cognitive rampage. My book, The Cognitive Rampage, A Scientific Approach to Self-Discovery, Change, and Life Optimization, is now available on Amazon. What I do in the book is I fuse the latest research from the cognitive, behavioral, social, environmental, and biological sciences. It's not just motivational fluff and wordplay. Now, I do talk about my own story, so there's some kind of inspiration in there, but I'm not just spinning words and hyping you up with motivational fluff. Whether you need a life change, simply enjoy self-exploration and optimization, want to discover new hidden passions, or reduce the life-altering effects of toil, anxiety, depression, all of those issues, this book is for you. This book is not a cookie-cutter method of steps to follow. You'll customize the scientific framework with your own personal beliefs to build your authentic change. That way you assimilate it faster and quicker. It's not just copying my beliefs and telling you step one, step two. These will come from your beliefs as how you extend and build the foundation upon this framework. You'll use this framework throughout your whole life, through every change, and through every age. These are not empty words of motivational spin. This book is an experience. The Cognitive Rampage is based in science and is built from your beliefs. It's a path to help you unleash your desired change. You can apply this method on your own with no harmful side effects. Speaking of no harmful side effects, October 21st, I will be in Orlando, Florida, doing a Cognitive Rampage workshop. I call it Moving Beyond Life's Transitions. Essentially, this is going to be a kick-in-your-front-door interactive cognitive rampage. That's what the workshop's about. We're going to go through my theory, transrational structure behavior theory, essentially right through the book at warp speed, and really be questioning a lot of things, but you're going to learn rational self-analysis, how to build your own life philosophy. You'll actually have one when we're out of there. We're going to go through the inventory, the IT inventory that I created, reveals a whole lot about our lives. But if you are struggling with addiction, depression, anxiety, just feeling stuck, or maybe just one like to push the boundaries of life optimization, self-discovery, that is okay. You don't have to be at rock bottom. Or you can be at rock bottom. But come join me October 21st, 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. It's all Saturday afternoon cognitive rampage affair. But you can get tickets at adamlowry.com. You'll find them there. And look, if you know a friend who's just struggling financially and can't afford a ticket, when you purchase your ticket and register, just add plus one. And they can show up with you, and we'll know that plus one is for that. I don't want anybody to miss this just because they can't afford it. So you can help a friend out, too, along the way, while also building a little self-awareness and change in your own life on the same day. So, again, just go to Adam Lowry, AdamLowery.com, and you can purchase tickets there. My guest on this podcast is a good friend, Dr. Parker Mott, but we recorded this podcast on Tuesday, October 3rd. It's now Friday, October 6th. That's where we're dropping this podcast today on iTunes. But Dr. Parker Mott, we went to high school together, and we reconnected a couple years ago, actually, over the podcast. He was the first guest on the podcast with our good friend Eric Rittenberry. But I recently moved back to Orlando from the West Coast, and he finally got over to the house and over to the studio so we could record. And what was odd about this is the last time Parker was on the podcast, we had a podcast planned, and just before we went live, the Pulse shooting happened, and we ended up dedicating that a whole show talking about the Pulse tragedy. And now on this podcast, before he came on, the Vegas shooting happens. So Parker and I spend about an hour and a half, a little more than that, talking about the actual mental health impacts, what that really means. Now, this is not your generic conversation about the mental health impact of that. You actually may hear a little different. We actually bring up two solutions that we thought, despite your party affiliation or beliefs on the typical two topics that most people talk about when a tragedy like this happens, that being guns and mental health. These seem to be the topics, but as Parker and I get into it, you may be a little surprised about both his opinion as a practicing psychologist and mine as a trained mental health counselor about what we're really doing when we're talking about mental health and guns, and if that's even rational as a discussion. But again, we also offer some solutions, so I hope you enjoy the podcast, and our hearts and minds go out to those that are have been affected by the tragedy in Vegas. And possibly Parker and myself can, I don't know, shed a little light in such a dark topic. But without any further ado, my friend, Dr. Parker Mott.
And we're live. What's up, brother?
It's good to see you again.
You too.
It's been a long time.
It has. And tragically enough, it's just strange that what a year ago with Pulse, you came on the podcast. We had lined something up.
Mm-hmm.
We're about to do our notes, or your notes, really. You had deep
right.
I even posted the video on Facebook today of you sitting out back pre-studio going over what you're going to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And Pulse happens, and we go live and do a whole show that mm-hmm. night, you know, just talking about all of the incidents. And then we schedule a podcast, what, last week?
Mm-hmm.
We schedule it for Tuesday at 9.
Yeah.
And then Vegas happens. That's just, I don't know, it's strange, man.
Yeah, it's, I guess it's tragedy that keeps bringing us together in some ways. And the good thing is that we did have both of these things scheduled. And it's, you know, I think last time a lot of people really got a lot from us talking about the Pulse nightclub shooting. I know we helped a lot of people, and we helped people process that all around Orlando.
Yeah,
we got a lot of really good feedback from that, and hopefully we can do the same today.
I was actually talking, I won't say, but a major local news channel, one of the people that had been on scene from the beginning, was actually reaching out. Him and I, he and I were exchanging emails back and forth with it, because they were up for like 16, 25 hours straight, you know, trying to bring the news of what was happening, and they're really going through it. And I think they've been bringing counselors down to the scene, et cetera. But yeah, it's mm-hmm. wild, man. It's that tragedy again that brings us together in a way, right? But mm-hmm. I don't know, this one, it almost feels like felt like more of a shockwave of, I can't trust anybody anymore, mm-hmm. You know, trying to see that pull together thing, you know, between uh-huh. Trump yelling at Puerto Rico and mm-hmm. they're going through hell, you know, this, you know, happening like that. It's just, you see this in the guns, right? Mm-hmm. The gun talk, the mental health talk, that split. It's starting mm-hmm. to see like more when this happens, it splits us more and more instead of the bring together.
It does. And, you know, and to add to that, we've just had three major hurricanes come through, mm. Harvey, Irma, and Maria down in Puerto Rico. And
yeah, Houston.
I think so many of these tragedies, I wonder if it's starting to desensitize people to situations like that, that it seems much more common now. Tragedies like 9/11 brought the entire country together for a substantial period of time. It really unified us, and it seems like tragedies now, I don't know if it's because they're politicized or what, but it seems like it's more divisive. That it, possibly how it's covered in the media, that we always look to who's doing what, who's not doing what, who's to blame, who's not to blame. And I think it's pulling at people people's differences, and it pulls us apart in a lot of ways.
Well, psychologically speaking, right? I mean, that's what you do. Well, what does it really do to a human being that does sit down and watch hours and hours, and or even just gets the news from the blips or the tickers, right, of these major news stations, right? And we'll call them party-affiliated news stations, right? Pick one so we can play middle ground. But
right.
What's that do to a human being's psyche over time?
It desensitizes them to it. When you constantly see the things that we now see on TV, on the internet, on Facebook, on all sorts of social media, I think we become more desensitized, and I hate to say a little bit used to it. Hmm. You know, that it's like, oh, look, another tragedy, or look, oh, another school shooting or whatnot. And the first time we have it, it's a big shock. It's very devastating. But yeah. The more we see things like that, it seems like, you know, that some ways less of a reaction that we have. And I think the media plays a big role in that, because they make tremendous amounts of money off of people's suffering and tragedy. And then instead of continuing to cover it, they're on to the next news story that's a tragedy in order to keep viewership. So they're constantly putting out new tragedies to advertise their product, to watch their channel.
Yeah. So I had a guy, I was on the Mindset Mountain podcast, they interviewed, I think it was Monday night, but they asked a question that I actually thought about you in the response. Like, you know, I'm going to ask that when we chat is, you know, trying to define the mindset of someone that goes into an act like that, something, you know, so horrifying. Mm-hmm. And speaking, if you will, kind of the, you know, what we're talking about, the influence of the media, side picking, the social influence, whatever, culture, how that actually can push a person psychologically to come to that place. What's that mind state like? Mm-hmm. You know, where are they at? Are they just crazy, right? Walk somebody through that.
I think this one, so far, it's been different because we have no motive yet still. Nobody knows why this is, why this person did this. And I think when we have answers or we have some sort of motive, it gives us something to process, something to try and understand and wrap our heads around to explain it in a way that sits well with us and ourselves. So far, there hasn't been a motive. None of this has really made sense to a lot of people. You know, it's a 64-year-old Caucasian male who opens fire on what's considered a largely conservative crowd. You know, there's no history of things. There's no he seems to be you know, have had a career, have been able to be financially stable and well off. Maintained relationships, like, and I think
they found like 42 guns. Right, it was like 42 guns and on the floor with them. I mean, this was planned out.
Yeah, I mean, there was large amounts of guns in the hotel, and large amounts of guns at his house. And you know, there's a lot of questions. I mean, this took place in the middle of Las Vegas, which, you know, you can't walk out of there with stealing a towel because there's cameras on you. Mm. How did somebody like this get in there? And I think one of the explanations that people, or one of the reasons why people seek explanations, is to look at how to prevent it from happening again.
Sure.
We can only do so much. We can't prevent every bad thing that happens in life. And I think that's one of the roles of that the media plays, is instilling fear in people. This in particular, this shooter, what stood out to me when I first heard about his age. You know, I think what the investigators are doing right now is an autopsy to see if there's something in terms of early onset dementia or any sort of neurological problems or something in his background of health. You know, learning that he had terminal illness or something recently to have influenced this or caused him to snap, which also leads them to a stressor. You know, looking at a stressor, what could cause somebody who seems relatively normal to break like that? So I think we could get into stress plays a factor, relationships, past history, all of that, but you know, right now, so much little is known. Nothing's really been identified or found.
Yeah. They bring up a good point about not being able to stop every, you know, mm-hmm. tragedy, right? And I was pretty open on the Mindset podcast about my views on it. Mm-hmm. And I think if we talk about gun control, are we talking an irrational argument here on, mm-hmm. on some level? Are we really – and I understand change takes a giant change. I mean, I get it. To make right. change, you got to make big moves, something right. different.
Exactly.
You know, but I still say that if we're talking about, you know, things like gun control or even mental health mm-hmm. as being the solver to end all, to be all of this – I think that's an easy target in a conversation that keeps you on the surface, you know, and whatever root problems that it really may be coming off of, maybe the, mm-hmm. like we talked about, the marketing, the television, the society pushing in on you, right? Changing the mind of the psyche, right? Of what success is, what happiness is. But I'm with you. I was pointing out, I said there's just not enough, you know, to tell.
Right.
Like you, I guess, some sort of brain issue mm-hmm. Mixed with a lot of things. You know, yeah. I think there was a lady involved that he was with and then mm-hmm. not with. But, you know, I think you were talking on why people try to figure it out, right? So we can stop it from happening. But I think some people we know we can't.
Mm-hmm.
But that need to find why. I mean, is it... Do we ever really understand why someone does something like that?
No, well, no, I don't think we do, because every case is different. Each individual case is varies in some form or another. So we can't predict everything. Mm-hmm. There isn't a single psychological test out there that can predict violence. Yeah, we can point to some suggested aggressive tendencies, but there's not a test out there to be able to predict things like abuse, violence, you know,
see,
stuff
that's a
like
good
that.
Point.
So I think yeah. you can't test people. You can try and predict certain profiles, and that's about the best they can do, is look at profiles of people. And so far, this one breaks the profile of a lot of that.
Yeah, I can hear people, right, is going, well, don't they have a test, right? We can make sure everybody will never do this, right? And you hear that a lot when the mental health topic mm-hmm. comes up, right? It's like, oh, they should have mental health screenings, and then I don't know, one counselor is going to sign off on anybody to be like, yeah, they can have a gun, right? I just don't see that happening, right? So it's the idea yeah. of that the subjective idea of what's mm-hmm. the mental mindset of how do you really even, you know, stop that?
Yeah, and I think you see on the news a lot of the talk is about, how did this person get a gun? And we need to do more in-depth background checks, and we need to get in their psychological records.
Right, this is what you
hear.
Whoa,
we're getting into health records now to determine, you know, so then you're crossing into some personal health information
HIPAA
protected
violations,
by HIPAA.
Maybe. Yeah.
You know, there is not any... background check today that can check people's mental health status or psychological well-being. Sure, if somebody has been arrested and sent into a mental health facility, there might be a record somewhere in his criminal record showing that he was involuntarily hospitalized or some form. But then there's where's the line about whether he can have a gun or not? Is it somebody who broke up with his girlfriend and went through a period of depression and just ended up in a bad place one night? Or is it somebody who has persistent mental health, who legitimately has some issues with violence and violent tendencies and difficulty with, a lack of empathy for others?
Yeah.
So I don't think there's any way to really measure that, and there's no real way to conduct those tests, especially on a large scale level to where we test everybody who has a weapon.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So those that are going, well, we should have deeper tests, right? The psych evals to consider, right? The subjectivity, where that line is drawn, right? Mm-hmm. For you, right? Where is the line drawn? Where, you know, we use history, right? We're going to mm-hmm. pull from their past experience, history. But even then, we can't predict, right, that snap.
We can only predict. I mean, that's the criteria for involuntary or voluntary hospitalization is, are they currently a threat to themselves, or are they currently a threat to somebody else?
Yeah.
So you can only deal with that thing based off of the current state that they're in. There's no way to predict it.
Mm. And I mean, that's part of this. So I guess when I do hear the mental health argument come up, I kind of go, well, yeah, but okay, maybe it was. Maybe that was – it had a role. Of course it did. Look what they did. They snapped on something.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the suggestion? I tend to want to look for solutions, right? Instead of just, mm-hmm. you know, I don't know, following the masses of what seems like a deeper solution, right? Take all the guns mm-hmm. away. Right? It sounds good, you know, but is there a real rational argument to be made there? I mean, there's more guns than people in the country. I mean, is there a psychological real argument for that?
Well, I think, you know, I want to go back to one other point real quick, too, is that there seems to be a lot of psychologists and professionals involved in serial killers who are closely watching this case because, you know, this doesn't seem like an act of traditional terrorism. It doesn't look like, you know, a traditional act out of passion. And I think a lot of the people who have studied serial
terrorism?
Killers, well, you know, if you want to define terrorism, sure, it could be. But terrorism is in terms of what we traditionally think about the Middle East and things like that, or what we see around the world a lot of the time. But I think those who study serial killers are watching this very closely to see if it was something that was much more calculated and very similar patterns to that of a serial killer who was maybe planning this in terms of maybe a lack of empathy or something like that. Almost like a Ted Bundy or a Jeffrey Dahmer type of thing, but how it was carried out was more so going out in a big bang type of thing.
Yeah, which is a little different than trying to stay hidden in what you're doing. And that was just saying
traditional serial killers have gone on for a number of years and evaded law enforcement and very sophisticated and charming and got away with it for a long time, doing horrible acts.
This would be more like considered a psychotic act or a break.
I don't know if we could call it psychotic. I mean, was he that cold and calculated to fly under the radar to this extent?
Right, kind psychotic,
of like a,
right? How do you
kind
sneak
of like
in?
A Hannibal Lecter type of thing.
Yeah, how do you sneak in 44 guns and say it was a psychotic break?
Yeah, no, right. If you've ever seen somebody who's been in the midst of something like that,
That would make me question the dementia part, too, because if you didn't walk in with a case of 44 guns, right? This had to come in one at a time in some form, in my guess, so that seems like a long
evading security,
out.
Evading, metal detectors.
Yeah, that's not somebody with dementia. I worked in a dementia ward in a unit for a while. I mean, no.
Yeah.
You know, even early onset, that it would be done.
No, I think he built a platform or something from what I understand while he was in there. So, I mean, and housekeeping had been in. He'd been there for over a week, I think. And nothing was out of the ordinary. And in Las Vegas, there's a lot of things out of the ordinary, but they also keep pretty close ties on certain things, too.
Yeah, it's the argument of how much freedom do you give up, right, for the safety. We went through it with 9/11 and TSA, and now every stand-up in the world has bits about, you know, TSA and how bad we hate it and we make jokes, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's what it really comes down to. When you're talking, do something mental health for it, do something with guns, you're still talking, whether you agree or disagree, it's someone's right. That they believe in. So you're still talking about now changing serious rights of people and the freedoms we have. I mean, like we talked about HIPAA. That's really the conversation we're having if the conversation starts with mental health and guns.
And I think that's an individual question. You know, we're trying to make national policies for the masses based off of how much safety are you willing to, you know, how much freedom are you willing to give up for your safety versus how much freedom am I willing to give up for my safety?
And then when the two have a disagreement of the perception of fear, of threat, when one side's going, it's all fear mongering, one side's going, no, they're all going to kill us tomorrow. Yeah.
Well, I think you just said it. You just cut to the heart of it all. It's fear. You know, so much of our behavior every day is controlled by fear, and we don't even realize it. You know, from the minute we wake up in the morning to choosing the clothes we wear to put on, choosing what we choose to eat, choosing the jobs that we have, how we drive to work, what we do at work, the relationships we have. There's an element of fear that controls a lot of those decisions every day.
Yeah, I've made that argument that I think I was feeling real pessimistic one night and made the argument that we don't fall in love, we fall in fear. that mm-hmm. we tend to share fears with people. And when we match those fears, yeah. we tend to mix that together and call it love. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't sound very good, but
it's not very romantic, Shakespeare.
Right. But from a rational standpoint, I was kind of saying, yeah, it's driven by fear, right? We don't, we go to work to the job because we want to have the house, provide yeah. food, et cetera.
Or we go to work because we're afraid of not having that or losing that.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we're driven a lot by that, and when the media does do a mass showing of all of this, and it's mm-hmm. and it's shown, I wonder how much, you know, PTSD can actually affect electronically, right? If you're mm-hmm. so wrapped into social media and all your, and news, if that's all you're watching is the coverage of that, mm-hmm. what that actually does to the person who may not have experienced it one-on-one mm-hmm. or in person, but, you know, and just immerses themselves, mm-hmm. you know, in that kind of news over and over, what that does to help shape somebody's view of the world.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, over the last 10 or 20 years, they've really studied the concept of vicarious traumatization, you know, being traumatized by watching other people's trauma. And it is a thing where they suffer very similar symptoms of PTSD, similar to that of those who've gone through the trauma.
Damn, see, so we do have
to be,
me.
Yeah, we have to be very careful about what we watch and what we allow our children to watch.
Yeah, well, the watching I get, but the mm-hmm. actual be studying symptoms, people having actual symptoms from virtual exposure to mm-hmm. other people's PTSD or other people's sure. trauma.
Well, it's been a concept that they've studied in psychologists over the years of you working with somebody who's been through a trauma. Yeah. And them sharing their horrific experience with you, that it's not uncommon for sometimes a psychologist to develop a form of PTSD in response to listening to the stories of their patients.
Yeah, you learn to a couple of years in the clinics, right? You just hear a few stories and you go, somebody else tells you something. You're like, mm-hmm. really? That's it? You're not adding anything to that? Oh, yeah, you'll be fine. You know, people are like, are you serious? You know, they're looking at you, do.
Well, see, that's a perfect example of desensitization. Mm-hmm. You know, that you've heard something so much worse that when you see something that's you deem not as bad, you don't have as much empathy towards it. And mm-hmm. I think, you know, we have to watch out for that in our society is, you know, are we not having as much empathy for those who go through hurricanes or in other countries suffering certain ailments or shootings as much that, yes, we look at it and we're like, oh, that's a horrible thing. I can't believe that would happen. Who would do that? And then we go about our day with little to no thought about it.
Well, there's a lot of studies coming out about social media exposure, how long you're on certain social media sites, given what you're following, the influence it has on your mood, creating mm-hmm. depression. They show increase of anxiety and depression from those that are on social media a lot. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe we're not wired, right, to receive all that kind of information at once, right? Mm-hmm. We're still just blood and tissue moving around and barely understanding our own mind's operation. And mm-hmm. then you're just hit with this constant exposure.
Well, if you look at what social media and the internet and electronics are doing to us today, you know, we're all overstimulated. We're all kind of hooked into this network in the country where we're overstimulated with everything that we're doing. Technology has been great with certain things, you know. Things that used to take us 3 hours to do now takes us 30 minutes. Yeah. Well, instead of using that 2 hours and 30 minutes of free time now to enjoy life and expand our, you know, quality of life, we're using it to fill more stuff to do in there, more work, more things. So I think we're completely overstimulated. And then when you overstimulate us with negativity, overstimulating us with traumas, there's something that's going to affect our physiology.
Yeah, it changes it. You can create groupthink. I mean, mm-hmm. in the Tribe of Change, I was the first one really, putting on a share of going, look at the corruption, pulling shit from the dark web, right? Just, mm-hmm. I was all over it. And then I'm like, wait, I'm adding to it, right? We know corruption exists, right? I had to pull that out. And it was kind of a change, really, if you will, of a focus. But if somebody is immersed in it all day, I mean, it does. It has an effect on your view of the world and others. And mm-hmm. yeah, I think your outlook on tomorrow, even.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think we've completely become addicted to electronics. I was sitting there the other day watching a football game, and I put my, a commercial comes on. And what's the first thing you do when a commercial comes on?
No, well, I don't watch TV. I don't have TV.
Well, either,
I just have...
either you pick up your phone, or if it's Netflix or something like that, you fast forward it through stuff
something,
because
right.
Now you've efficiently can watch a TV show that was 30 minutes and now like 20.
So we've come a long way from the
fit
VHS.
More stuff in it. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
There's kind of a draw. I mean, the reaction you have to leaving your cell phone somewhere.
Oh,
that separation anxiety that you have from that.
Yeah.
Somebody
thinks they lost their phone. It's been like 5 seconds.
Oh, yeah.
They're like, wait, stop everything.
Where's it at?
Pull over. You're like, wait, what? Oh, never mind. It's in my pocket. You know?
So, I mean, we are that connected to sources of information in news. And news that, there's a big talk right now about fake news. And the truth of the matter is pretty much all news is fake in some ways.
Yeah.
Every news channel does put a spin on some form of news, or they present the news and then put a spin on it.
Yeah. Even the local channels, too. There's a great documentary out that talks about how the big broadcast companies own the certain local markets. So the certain specials they run about it's very heavily weighted on one side or the other, even the local ones, and they do small twists because you're used to the local spiel, right? If you watch that shit, but they'll work in just small phrases when they talk about one party or the other or one view. Over time, man, when you expose that shit night after night after night, people come home from work watching Channel 9. You're watching your local person, and they're slipping in just that little jargon, that little twist right there. You don't even notice that little bias. And, over time, man, that really starts to wear on you.
It does. And I really, really watch the language and the process by which people are doing it, because most of the time it slips by and people, I'll watch the news with somebody and I'll say, hey, did you see that? You see what they said? And no, I didn't. Yeah. What do you, and I'm like, that right there is one of the methods that they use to shape the way you think about things.
Yeah.
Earlier you and me talked about maybe doing a podcast one day where we sit there and we watch the news and we inform people about what they're doing in the moment to try and draw people in or to anger people or to shape their mentality about a certain thing. So I think we're
a few of those watching people's motivational videos, watching their little spiels going, no, I'm talking live, just commenting right at, oh, really? You're going to, I'm just like you, huh? Right. And I do that and walk through it, man.
Should do that with news. I think that would be something. And we can do it with a variety of channels and look at different topics, because I think you have to learn how to take the news for what it is and get what you can out of it without buying into the bigger picture. And I think the younger generation, I don't think, believes the news quite like they used to. I think the older generation is the one who grew up with the famous newscasters, the trusted people at 6 o'clock that
in the paper on the porch.
Exactly. So I think, and of course some of it was going on back then too, but news was much different then, because it was the rating system was different then. And once they started including the news in the rating system, and channels could use the rating system of the news in order to sell airtime for commercials, it became more of a business.
Now I got to be entertaining.
And then it had to become entertaining. But going back, we took a turn there.
Yeah.
But going back, I mean, that's what we're being fed, is we're being overfed information, and we're being fed distorted information that's leading us to all be a little bit brainwashed in some way.
Okay. Now I am verified that I'm insane. What we immerse ourselves in, what our environments are in, what we listen to, right? This does have an effect on us. So obviously it can affect someone's, view and, experience of life. For me, when I first heard it, and I actually got Twitter. I mean, that's where a lot of people get their news now from, too, is social media.
Mm-hmm.
That's where it kind of becomes an issue, too, because social media has bait click or,
some of those are blatantly fake.
Right, right. And
like,
so,
sit around and, hey, what are we going to talk about today that's fake? Let's make up a story to put on.
So, yeah, but I mean, that's where most people find their news, if you ask me. It's you're pulling the social media. If it's big, it's shared quickly. It gets out. Maybe that's the problem, too, with grabs on, gets shared so quickly. But when I first heard it, all I could do was put myself in I was listening to BBC, actually, the podcast on BBC. They're usually the day before, they're right on point, and I know they're biased somewhere, but I like it. But anyway, they were just telling a story of a certain person who was there in the experience. And all I could try to imagine is that view that they're going to have, you know, in their head, right? This repeated view of the girl who was dancing next to her, takes a couple steps back, you know, grabs her stomach, looks at her, and then just kind of shrieks out and falls over, right? I mean, to get a view like that, I mean, the PTSD that comes in from that, the people, I mean, this is a war zone, right? What they're experiencing. For me, all I could imagine is, you know, her having to deal with that repeated view, the woman who was shot, her family then. I mean, this was all people in the middle of a good time, right? The change like that, that rapid, greatest time of my life to a nightmare, right? That rapid. How do you even begin to talk to somebody about dealing with something like that and changing their perception, if you will, on something that was, at least for them, the most intense thing in the world?
You listen to them.
Yeah.
You know, you just listen to them and you listen to their story. I think that's, there's nothing you can say to fix it for them. Yeah. There's nothing you can do. You know, that is something that's going to be cemented into their thoughts and their vision forever. The best thing you can do is start to listen and help them work through it, help them process it. Because one of the things about trauma is that there's a physiological process that goes on that's imprinted in your brain. So it's almost kind of like you're frozen. Mm. And what you have to do as a therapist is to help unfreeze people so that they can move through the trauma and move on.
Yeah, we get stuck in that repeated pattern of what could be, what was, what might be. It links to a lot of anxiety, right? Where people don't go certain places, repeat patterns that brought on that experience. I mean, shit, it scared the shit out of me because my daughter loves to go to concerts. And for me, it just seems like a lot of this stuff is at concerts and giant gatherings, right? So I'm immediately, then I observe myself in the fear that I have about, and then I go, wow, if, you know, if it pulls me, when I'm trying to be aware of its influence on me over, you know, my thoughts of what my daughter loves to do and where she has fun, I'm like, God, those that aren't trying to be aware, you know, because I even borderline where I go, no, I don't know about these concerts, right? And I'm going, wait, what am I doing? Right? You have to catch that.
You project the fear onto them. And fear spreads, you know, it is like an infection that you can, you can look at it like, well, you know, maybe I don't want to go to a concert anymore, but you start to become fearful if something happens to your daughter.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, it's one thing if it happens to me, but it's another thing if it happens to my loved one.
Then the rules change. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's the struggle, I think, for a lot of people, right? When it's when it does involve somewhere, has involved tragically someone close to them, you know, when you do step away and go, we have to now do something about it, right? You feel that drive to it. I mean, the same with the hurricane, right? I'm like, I want to be like, Trump, just go to the island for a minute, leave your little, you know, your lush hotels, step out of it for a minute, and go. Just do 3 days without power. Right. Just and see if you still want to tweet like somebody's talking some shit. You know, like, fuck. You know, help. Help, but we really can do anything, right, to stop this, right? I mean, I hate to sound like a cop-out. I'm just playing the other side.
We can do what we can do, but we can't prevent every bad thing that happens in the world. You know, bad things have happened to people since, you know, the beginning of time. That is a cycle of life. Not to say that this was a natural cycle of life, but you know, the rabbit eats the grass, the fox eats the rabbit, the wolf eats the fox. You know, so there is a cycle of life here that's happening. And granted, this is, you know, it's a bad way of kind of describing what happens, but we can't, in a bigger sense, we can't stop everything bad that happens in life. The thing that we have to do is not live our lives in fear. You know, I think when we live our lives in fear, the terrorists win. You know, evil wins when we live our lives in fear. When we say, "Oh, I'm not going to go to a concert anymore," or "I'm not going to go to a sporting event." You know, I the way I say it is, you know, I'm going to continue to go to a sporting event. And, you know, people say, well, you know, you need to do stuff and not live your life in fear, but just be aware. Well, being aware is also...
Do you think about arming yourself when you go?
No. No, I don't.
No?
No. Because I feel like that would be part of me living in fear.
Mm.
And I don't want to do anything... you know, we all live in fear in some ways. I have my own fears that I battle every day.
Yeah.
The last thing I want to do is add to them. So, you know, I'm going to continue to go to sporting events and concerts.
Yeah.
And will it cross through my mind? It might, you know, but I'm also going to not let it control me. You know, I know people who go to a sporting event and they say, well, you know, I'll just get close to an exit and I'll look out for people. I'm like, well, you're going to a sporting event or a concert and you're living in fear while you're there.
Mm,
you know, can you enjoy that when you're constantly...
That's what we repeatedly say, right? It's just keep on doing what we're doing, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then there's the two sides, right, that argue, well, we have to stop it from ever happening, right? So pull all the guns from everybody. And, I mean...
That's not going to solve it either. I mean, you know...
Wouldn't
they
just
don't
be
have...
a knife, maybe? I mean, I hear on BBC...
Well, that's what's happening in Europe. You know,
yeah,
I mean,
you see that
people
in Europe
are running around with swords.
Yeah, there's swords and knives. They're stabbing women.
Driving through crowds with semis. Do we ban semis? Do we ban cars?
In Charlestown, there was a damn car, you know? It does.
I mean, we can't prevent everything, and I think Las Vegas, with all the cameras, with all the security, on a 30-something floor with glass like that, you know, I've heard talk about. Well, could we? You know, they should have done more security at the concert. Well, nobody was in the concert. That was
30. What
they could have had the best
31,
security
32.
There was. It was 400 yards away from the concert.
Right. He's what up 32 to 32 flights, something like that.
Yeah. I mean, it's what's going to happen. I mean, you could be standing in a concert and a meteor flies through.
Yeah.
We can't stop everything. And
the point you're making though is we're talking, you know, Ocean's 11, 13 type security stuff. You know, it's the most camera, most secured place. And it's the point proven that even in that kind of tight-knit security at concerts and things that we really can't do anything, right? Do we run everyone through mental health screenings and tests? And now we pick out who goes in the pen, who doesn't. We get into a real violation there. But why are people then so drawn, right, to just stand behind the thing of like, take all the guns away, don't take all the guns away, background checks for everybody. Everyone should have mental health screenings.
Well, we've talked about it. It's fear.
Yeah, I mean, but they toot
driving.
That horn, right? They just go, here is the cause, here's what I identify with, right? And they run with it when it seems to... I mean, I don't know. It seems irrational of an argument, or maybe I'm too much of a pessimist.
It is. And, I think people are upset and they want to do something and they don't know what to do, but they feel like there has to be something, and there can be something. We can sit down, we can have dialogue, we can figure out where mistakes were made, we can figure out where to do better.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, you can't predict something that happens less than, you know, 0.001% of the time. I mean, you can't predict something so freak at times.
Yeah.
And I think it does. It all comes back to fear.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, and let's face it. What mental health help do we put them in presently, right? I mean, so someone doesn't have income, disability barely covers bills, right? They may be actually really feeling, you know, the impacts mentally, socially, et cetera, on an extreme scale. Mm-hmm. Usually have the hardest time getting help. There are programs that they offer, but we know how these programs operate in counseling and what they really do for you. And I mean, what kind of help do we really offer? You know what I mean? What's the back end help? Well, offer more help. That sounds good too. Here's a solution. Offer mental health help for everybody, right? Sounds good.
Yeah.
What? How do we do that? How does that even?
I think
is that rational?
One of the things that we have to focus on now is sure we need to always look at mental health, because mental health is always on the back burner of everything. We need to put it, you know, in the forefront of everything we do, and we need to educate people. We should go into schools and talk about things like cognitive theory.
Yeah,
you know, talk about what thoughts and feelings are, how to cope with thoughts and feelings. And it's just basic biology, basic physiology about how our body works. Yeah. Because people, they go to school and they say, you know, here's an arm and here's a femur and here's the brain and here's all these body parts and these are how they work to live together. But there's no emphasis on how the mind works, how thoughts work, how feelings work, and how they're interconnected, and why we feel the way we feel, why we behave the way we behave. Because I think those are school, classes that we can teach in school that will generally help people understand why they think and feel like they do when they get older as an adult and get into situations that are difficult for them.
Yeah, the last podcast I did, or two ago, I can't remember, I covered that. I covered how we need to teach the kids psychology, and they can pick it up. And if at a young age we can teach them what they'll experience, what they what feelings really are, where they come from.
Oh, they eat it up. They, you know, I have a lot of high school kids and middle school kids who come in who, you know, they're telling me all about their psychology courses, and they're including, you know, they're asking me questions, and they're like, I understood this because we talked about it, and it makes sense. So
some schools have it, but a lot of times it's just the history, really, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Go, keep going.
Yeah, so I find a lot of kids, that is a class that they feel is useful, you know, because it directly impacts things that they deal with every day, which is their thoughts and feelings, which they don't always understand, particularly in adolescence.
Yeah, I agree. I think I was talking also in the Mindset podcast about, you know, trying to offer solutions, right? I was doing a lot of bitching. So, you know, a solution to, like, right, people, you know, are screaming, trying to get behind some. Hey, at least you're trying to come up with something.
Right.
You know, it was an idea of, hey, maybe we end all, you know, spending on wars, et cetera, focus on mental health. Mm-hmm. But it was like, look, if we can focus on the kids, the new crop, give them the tools before it develops, maybe that's more of a rational focus. Mm-hmm. You know, if we put money into psych classes earlier ages, right? Not just send them when something's wrong, right? Mm-hmm. Let's not be reactive in psychology. Our medicine's already reactive enough. If we can be proactive and teach the kids that, I mean, increase the education there, focus on a good couple crops, and maybe, you know, in a generation rotation, we could actually eliminate, you know, crazy mass murders that way in some way. But even then,
well, here's the thing is, America as a society is doing something very wrong. We are doing something wrong. Our society is going in a bad direction, and we all have to wake up as a group, as a collective group, to say something's not right here in this country, that we've screwed up, whether it's our education or social media or something. Our society as a whole, as people, as humans on this planet, are moving in the wrong direction. And we have to, as a collective group, decide to change that. And I think that's what makes things so difficult in America. Is most people can agree that society and things are not going in a good direction. But we are continuing to be split, and we are split on things like race. We're split on education. We're split on gun control. We're split on all these things, and it's part of the government that does that. Because if we come together, Eric's in my ear right now.
I can hear Eric.
Because if we come together as a whole, as a group, we have power, and that's the last thing the government wants us to do. They want us to be focused on us as an individual.
Yeah.
Because if we're more concerned about ourselves, we're not concerned about the group. So when they split us apart, it takes away the power of society. But collectively as a whole, as a group, we are going in a bad direction that's going to be destructive in our future.
Well, yeah, even the group manipulation, I was watching on Vice, there was an era when the Republican side was coming out with how they could modify zoning districts for voters and collect Democrats in one or two counties in small locations, re-change the county lines to where it was mostly Republicans, you know, spread out to where they won more counties so they could win the state. It was like one guy that came up with this idea, and then they work it, right? The Democrats are starting to get into it. But it was still a utilization of that, right? It's right. Blocking out, grouping minimums. It becomes this game, an mm-hmm. easily played game, right? When you understand right. it, it doesn't seem like there's even legitimacy. I mean, I think Eric probably said it, but it echoes in my head, you know, was an honest question, which I love to ask people, which is, if do you believe the system in place can fix the system in place? If your answer to that is no, well, then you're a radical, my friend, because otherwise we're just being idiots, right? Assuming
in order to be self-correcting, you have to have awareness.
Yeah.
And the only awareness is for one's own benefit in Washington.
Well, the group divide that you speak of is a huge – it's huge because as long as we're – and these are heartfelt issues. Don't get me wrong. People have lost loved ones because of these issues. Mm-hmm. They're serious. I don't want to downgrade them, right? But the more they can keep us focused on our little fronts mm-hmm. and when our little tribe fighting this and fighting that, fighting this, well, then we miss the whole point of the corruption beneath all of that. Mm-hmm. You know, and what do we do? And I think that's why I probably sound – pessimistic when I said, let's not talk about the gun control and mental health. These are, unless you're willing to give up freedoms, let's not even put this on the table because we're going to start talking about freedom.
All of that's a symptom.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I think that's what I was saying on mindset. It's a symptomatic, right? It's getting down to the real corruption that the people's vote doesn't matter. Obviously, with the president in place, the majority doesn't, you know, work. Mm-hmm. The electoral college is the game that we play. The more red and blue states that we come, I mean, they just went all Bloods and Crips over the last 20 years, man. But, and we adapt to that team identification of that's who we are. I think that, shit, society's set up to keep us going so fast, so quick, that we know we have to be involved in politics. But we don't have time to really get that involved with politics, so I can quickly choose a color, choose the side with values that approach with what I believe, and then I'll believe whatever they're saying right now.
Even if it's the closest beliefs. When you really get down to it, I find that most people tend to be in the middle. But they have to choose a side which pushes them further. And any, you know, we've talked about episode, 23 or 24 with the cognitive theory that we did, the cognitive behavioral stuff. Everybody's flipping through their thing. Let me go find this podcast.
Oh, that was the one we tried to go deep in theories, where theories were coming from new practices. We were heavy on the cognitive. Yeah,
cognitive theory. Yeah, that was a good one.
You came prepared. You had like 18 piles of notes.
Yeah,
you
were, I had books and citations.
I'm trying to cheat off your shit. I'm like.
But I think we lost what we're talking about. But yeah, when we split things into dichotomies, black or white thinking, right or wrong, Republican and Democrat. If you're a Republican, that automatically makes the Democrats wrong.
Right.
You know, if you're a Democrat, the Republicans are wrong.
You don't
even if you agree on things, things are split into two categories of right and wrong. So, and that's where a lot of hate comes in, is when somebody starts viewing the other side as being evil. And that's what's happening in America, is we are viewing our brothers, sisters, family, friends as being bad, being evil, and they're not. That's what politics is doing, is it's pulling people apart. And that's exactly what they want them to do, because if we were to come together as a whole, we have too much power.
Yeah, that's the divide. And how do you really ask somebody that's lost a loved one due to a race issue, right, or a police issue, or whether the stats add up to anything, right? It's that person's experience, right? How dare you ask them to say that, well, statistically, that's not true because the answer of something, right, if you have the numbers person, they would say, well, you can be upset at it, but statistically, it's shown we're the best we've ever been here and here and here. Well, they're still the persons of that were those statistics. You know what I mean? Then that they experienced whatever that was.
I'll tell you, political and going through doctoral programs, we are trained to do research methods, to understand maths, to understand statistics. And any form of statistics related to politics are relatively the least accurate form of statistics. Yeah, you can make bad statistics like that. You can make them read anything.
Yeah.
The law of averages is the least reliable measure of statistic out there. Anytime you look at averages, it's one of the least.
That's all people want to see, right?
Everybody loves averages because it's easy.
This person's ahead by this much, right? Congress's likability percentage, right? They come up with all these, and we look, okay, we're 46%.
But when you conduct true medical peer-reviewed journal research, the statistics are solid because the statistical methods that they use incorporate error. They incorporate sample size. They incorporate effect sizes. They incorporate all sorts of different things.
Yeah. Not the nationwide green poll
exactly.
of somebody that put together that 70% of Americans.
That right. only one news station is reporting.
That's just like, if you believe those little things that pop up in news, you're believing all those magazines that you have to read when you're waiting in line at the grocery store. You know what I mean? If you're reading those headlines, that's almost the same thing as the same place you're getting the news from.
Well, I'll tell you a little trick to all of those out there listening is when you look at these polls or statistics like that, look for a little sign that says plus slash minus, and then it'll say a points, like 2 or 3 points. What that is called is a confidence interval. So what you want to do is add and subtract those points to each of the numbers. And if any of those numbers are the same, the statistic is basically no good.
Ah.
So let's say if somebody's ahead in the poll 51% to 49%, and there's a little plus or minus of 3,
right.
That means you can add plus 3 to the 49% and minus 3 to the 51%, thus showing that the poll is completely useless and it could be completely backwards. But people don't see that. Yeah,
right. It's really, here's some numbers, look at these, read the fine print, it means nothing.
But you won't see that. Usually you have to look at kind of at the small, but that's what that is. And of course, normal people who haven't studied statistics or statistical methods won't see that. And a lot of times, you know, the polls that are put on are just, you know, we've done our own poll, and well, who've they polled? You know, their sample size is 50 people in New York City, or you know, 100 people in Texas. So you know, you're not going to get a good sample size there.
Well,
you can shift, you can change the way you want to. And I'll tell you this quick story off topic, but back in school, one of the very first research projects we had to do was develop our own research project and go out and find people and conduct a study.
So what did you study?
I studied, this was it, the effect of alcohol use on grades.
Okay.
So
were you studying yourself?
No, I'm more ethical than that. You can't include yourself in a study. It's biased.
Right. You're right.
So I studied these about 5 to 10 people, only 5 to 10. But what I found was, through doing my analysis, was the more you drank, the better your grades came out.
No, you didn't.
That's exactly what I found. But it was because the sample size that I was using was amongst very intelligent people who, one didn't drink at all. The other one drank an average of like 10 beers a day in a frat. You know, so you had these outliers, and when you averaged everything out and calculated the statistics, it came out to be the more alcohol you drank, the better the grades were.
Yeah.
So it just goes to show that you can,
the law
based
of average
on
is
the
like
people,
the worst.
Based on, you know, location and stuff like that, you can, you know, shape the way statistics are.
And who the fuck's filling out a poll anyway?
I've never been asked
right.
a poll,
that's,
have you?
Yeah, when they call your house, say, well, if you, who has a, I don't have a home phone anymore. Uh-huh. But I mean, for one, who still has a home phone?
Who answers it?
Right. And who's saying yes to the poll, right? And then filling those things. I mean, that I really put that in question. Mm-hmm. You know, I always have a reason why I can't fill out the poll right now.
Mm-hmm.
I have to go. You know, so if we're taking.
I have to work, I'm sorry.
But it's the numbers. We just kind of, you know, we just want to look up and go, okay, they're ahead a little bit. You're right, or okay, it's doing okay, and we want to just move on with our lives. Yeah, we know what happened, you know, and then social media as well, right? Because we thumb through it, we read the little cap, and most of the time the title doesn't have shit to do with it, you know. And some marketing people I talk to are like, look, you got to use your title and say this, and I'm like, that has nothing to do with the post, and they're like, yeah, it doesn't matter. I'm like, fuck yeah, it does. It does. And then, right. No, you have to. It's about getting the clicks. I'm like, well, whoever's clicking on it for that shit doesn't want to read it anyway.
Right.
Right. But our attention has become the new currency. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, isn't that what we're selling away? Is our attention and time?
And they can measure it so easily now. You know, they know what you're liking on Facebook. They know what you're watching on TV. They, you know, it's so much easier to be tracked. I shouldn't have said that. You're freaking out now.
You got me looking now.
You're living in fear, aren't you?
No, you see that mask hanging over there. Yeah. You know what I'm ready. It break glass in case of a revolution.
Yeah.
You know, like the mask is ready anytime. And I think a lot of us feel like that from time to time, right? We have our moments, right, where we just say, forget it, right? We have to take it back. Or I was talking also how people – I guess they think they're doing something when they move out on their own, self-sustaining, you know. Mm-hmm. And I was kind of thinking, I'm like, you're saving yourself, yeah. You know, you're not adding a carbon footprint. I'm with you. Great things. But are you in the trenches, right? Mm-hmm. Are you helping? And then the answer may be, yeah, I'm involved in all this online stuff. I'm like, wait, you're connected, but you are self-sustaining on your own, right? Mm-hmm. There's so many different ways, man. And it's hard for me sometimes really not to look and play the chess pieces and really go – 14 moves here, and nobody's – sometimes we're pissed off about this for a little bit, and you know, how long will it be before it's either the next one? I was talking – my response when I first saw it on the Twitter, you know, when I saw what had happened in Vegas, it was again. I was just like, is it again? Really? Fucking again? Are you kidding? You know, it was just a tragic again, and then going through the thoughts and images that people had to experience.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that's that I felt myself being desensitized. Even. Right.
No, you do. And I think that's what we have to focus on is imagine putting ourselves there. That's the empathy, you know, putting ourselves in someone else's shoes and imagining their experience. And I think when we do that, it becomes real and we understand it as being more real.
Is that
and then for it to actually be happening, because just putting yourself there and imagining seeing the scenes and imagining experiencing the experience and then thinking that somebody actually was there and experienced that and the horror of that, that's how I think we keep a lot of our empathy and don't just scroll down the page.
Well, you know, what's happening with somebody that does, let's say, take a tragedy like this or anything else and curb it to a story to where, you know, they say, hey, I had a cousin once that went to this place and was there 7 years ago and then tell you this. And I'm like, well, I don't really know how that's connected, you know, and or if they were, hey, they stayed at the hotel that was two blocks from where this happened 8 years ago when they were on a business trip for 2 days. And man, you know, what's the want to be connected to that? What's the want to personalize the tragedy like that?
Well, I think there's everybody has their different motives. Some people want it for attention. Some people think about it in terms of making it real to them that, hey, they've been there. They've been in that scene. Not unlike people with the World Trade Center who lived and worked there, who had a personalized connection. And I think that's really what it is when people say things like that is they personalize their connection to where it happened.
Mm. Yeah, because I do walk through that of why a person would bring something that, you know, up to the forefront. And I don't know, it seems to be wanting to be connected to it, wanting to be involved to it or some way. Or maybe, or is it really just something where they do link a personal reminder or say something to it? I don't know, it's hard for me sometimes not to.
Well, I think it's healthier for people to kind of link a personal reminder to it than attention purposes.
What do I know? Yeah, fuck it. Why not? Mm-hmm. I know, but we don't want to remember it too much. It's such a weird line, right? Remember it forever. Mm-hmm. So we respect everybody that was injured or killed, right? We have to make a monument, remember it, right? And then, but in order to move on, we have to remember it, but yet move on from
it.
I
don't think people are remembering things like they used to.
Oh, I would agree.
You know, I think, you know, it's been slightly, you know, over a year since Pulse, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and how much does it affect somebody in, you know, Oklahoma or Texas? How often do they think about it? Yeah. I find that affects people localized more. We are probably more connected to it than most of the people around the country because this is our home and it happened here. And we know people who were there or were directly impacted, and those families will always remember it. Yeah. But the casual person out in California doesn't remember the date. Yeah. You know, they remember watching some of it on TV or something like that, or remember, you know, oh yeah, that was horrible.
But that earthquake they sat through, mm-hmm. you know, in Cali, right? That would be something that marks your calendar, right? Your mm-hmm. your proximity. When your proximity is affected
yes.
By the experience, it tends to weigh a little
and
harder.
And I think this is different for people in Florida maybe than people out west. I mean, this happened a long ways away. This happened out in the west.
Right.
And granted, you know, we've all been to Las Vegas and or something like that. So we do have a little bit more of that personalized feel to it, but sure. there's a lot of distance between the East Coast and the West Coast.
Yeah, and well, look, I thought about my daughter immediately, mm-hmm. right? I personalized it quick. Well, how could this affect me? Mm-hmm. You know, she loves to go to concerts. Well man, mm-hmm. I've watched concerts collapse, catch on fire, right? Or the clubs yeah. and things burn down, mm-hmm. Bombs overseas, right? The last one with the bomb at that mm-hmm. the one concert. I mean, I don't know. So I'm biased. I'm going, it's only happening at concerts and these things. That's how I see it. Mm-hmm. I personalized it immediately, right? That fear.
Right. Right.
That ignition of fear to then create a safety net of those around me in my mm-hmm. proximity.
Oh, yeah. No, you do. You personalize it, and then you start distorting reality to cater it, to say, oh, you know, it always happens,
right.
you know, yeah. at concerts, or it's always something at a concert. You know, well, it's not always at a concert. Most of the time it's, you know, protests or somebody driving a car through something or, yeah. You know, so I think you're using your thought distort, your own thought distortion
That's
when
right.
you start personalizing that. And the reason why you're doing that is because it's fear.
Yeah.
It's fear that leads you to using that thought distortion.
Perhaps the fear is what pushes those that support what maybe you and I may agree with, right? That is an irrational argument as a solution as far as taking the guns away or mental health mm-hmm. checks or treatment for everybody and being able to solve every bad thing from ever happening.
Right. We can't do it. We cannot do it. We can't save ourselves from everything. Yeah, we could lock ourselves in a padded room and, you know, protect ourselves from the outside world. But what type of life is that living? And we could still sit in there and die from asbestos and the padding in the wall or something. So, I mean,
yeah.
it's we can't save ourselves from everything. We can just do the best we can do, enjoy this life to the utmost extent that we can, you know, live every moment that we possibly can, doing everything that we've ever wanted to and dreamed of, free from the fear that holds us back of doing those things.
Yeah, well, most of the fear that comes, right, it's our personal self is the enemy, right? What we're afraid of, what we can't do, what we wish we would have done, right? We hold on to those things, man.
We do. It's most people never regret the things that they've done. They always regret the things that they didn't do. And my life's no different. I look back at things that I wish that I had done. And traditionally, it was some form of fear that held me back.
Yeah. Yeah, in some way. It's funny. I don't know. See, I even get bashful talking about it, right? One of my first loves was music, right? I was really into music. I loved to freestyle and mm-hmm. you know, spit some raps. I dug it. I did it for a long right. time. And I had a few chances to have some fun once in a while, but I never really took it serious, you mm-hmm. know, and never really saw it that way. I just kind of, it yeah. was fun, right? Mm-hmm. And everything changed in music anyway, right? But just the other day, hanging out here in the studio, some old friends came by now that I moved back to Orlando. And realized that we have a fully functioning working studio. Things that when we were kids, yeah. and when I say kids, when we were, you know, in our 20s or
last year,
we were young, man. It was like still high school, yeah. And we have it all here. What are we doing? And we ended up just recording and playing beats, making some things, and it was like it made me think, oh man. If there was another go-round, you know, maybe I'd try that or have fun with it. And I realized, hey, you know what? You can still do it. It doesn't have to become a thing or mm-hmm. make it somewhere. You don't have to define an outcome to it.
Yeah.
You can still follow that.
Start by doing it, and you never know where it leads.
Yeah, and for me, it's more about back then it would have been trying to lead to somewhere. For me, it would have been like make it. And for now, it's a lot more fun than mm-hmm. I think it would have been if it was something I followed then.
Right.
Now it's like there's no business plan. You know what I mean? We're just...
You're doing it for the real reason why you started doing it. And I think if you keep it simple, Keep it to where you love it. You know, it's that's all that matters.
I think that's important too for those that do experience, you know, a trauma like this, a tragedy and a trauma like the shooting, right? Mm-hmm. To keep doing it, right? Maybe that's why they do talk about that. It seems cliche, right, to say, hey, keep going out there, go to the concert again. Mm-hmm. You know, don't quit that, right? It's part of standing up. The UK was very vocal about it when they had some experiences, but no, mm-hmm. we're not changing shit.
Yeah.
You know, and you I guess that's really the answer.
I get
right?
angry. I get angry at it. I say, you know, I refuse to live my life in fear. Yeah. I'm going to attack fear in every possible way I can. And yeah, it creeps in. It creeps into my decisions. When I'm aware of it, I combat it. You know, when I'm not aware of it, I'm afraid until I do recognize it. And as soon as I recognize it, I take action to attack it.
Yeah. I think a lot of people don't focus on their own reaction to something, mm-hmm. realizing it's okay to have the action or the reaction, mm-hmm. being aware of that and then moving it backwards. And I'm glad you brought up anger too, and being able to use that for something good.
Right. I'm not a big proponent of anger being useful for much. Right. I really am not. You know, some people say it's good to be angry. It's good to process that. But if you're processing anger, you're processing the wrong feeling.
There you go.
Anger is the emotional reaction to us not getting what we want in life. You know, it's kind of a form of us pitching a fit.
A symptom.
But it's a symptom. It's acting out. But what's really underlying anger is hurt.
Yeah.
We are hurt that something happened that we didn't want to happen. Sure. We are hurt that something, you know, our plan didn't work out. And we are acting out in anger. So if you process the hurt behind the anger, you'll work through the anger.
And find fear, right? Because right above hurt is that fear.
A lot of ways, yeah.
Yeah, we've been
a lot
hurt,
of times so. It's the hurt that triggers the fear, that opens the door for it, because then you become afraid of being hurt again.
Right. And whether it's in a relationship, emotional, something, or even mm-hmm. just, you know, or going to concerts again, mm-hmm. Or even not being afraid to question your own reaction to it, mm-hmm. your own anger response of going, well, if you don't stand for the anthem, then fuck all you, right? And that same response, if we can maybe use that moment to study the reaction there, pause right. on it and process.
That's definitely an issue that's made a lot of people uncomfortable in this country. And it seems like the popular position is to, you know, want people to stand for the anthem. And I definitely understand their reason for doing it. And I definitely understand the
That's
reason
weird.
For kneeling.
I kind of came to, as I was observing what I thought was the majority, right? Where's the number leaning?
Right.
I'm in my own head, look, right? I'm even coming up with numbers in my own head. Right. Where's the majority? Where's the 52? Where's that percentage change?
Yeah.
And I thought to myself the actual opposite. I thought the majority had pushed now toward kneeling is okay and get mm-hmm. over. Once I saw Jerry Jones on a social media feed take a knee, I thought this is like the Captain America quarterback of the Cowboys who took a knee with the whole, you know, America's team, America's yeah. football team in Dallas. And I thought, okay, the majority has definitely shifted over.
No, this is a great opportunity. What news station were you watching?
No, it was social media feed.
Exactly. You know? So everybody gets a different perception of it. My perception comes from talking with people and getting a feel and, you know, a little bit of the news coverage.
Yeah.
Yours is, you know, I mean, you do see a lot of people on the news feeds burning jerseys, throwing away tickets, commenting on a lot of it. But either way, I think you
I
know,
say
I'm,
everyone's right because
I say
the,
everyone's right as well.
It's the right to their perception,
here's,
and
here's
I validate
the thing.
It.
All the change that's happened in America, it takes a level of being uncomfortable, creating a level of discomfort in this country in order to elicit some form of change. And we have almost got to that point. I mean, if you look at...
Yeah, we're way hard on the
you know,
uncomfortable.
Look at,
we're way hard on the it's getting uncomfortable scale, man.
I don't know.
This
you,
better be some great shit coming around the angle here, man.
Well, if go back to when they first allowed a black man to go to college in Mississippi.
Fucking, it was, yeah.
I mean, there were riots.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, that brave man walked into a college where not only was he very much hated in the college, but in the state and in the region and partly in the country. I mean, he created a great deal of discomfort for people.
Yeah.
And it took that in order to facilitate change.
And it was so violent as shit then. I think people forget they get played up on the speeches and repeated of how violent it was.
They had problems with a football team.
Colleges were getting, I don't want to say because like it was terrorism, because it really wasn't. They were fighting for something that was real, right? So they were just basically taking things over, shutting it down. It was it was violent. I mean, killing on both sides. People forget how...
Oh, yeah. People died over a black man going to college.
Yeah, it wasn't mace in the face. You know, it wasn't like somebody got maced for a sign. Shit was... people forget that, man.
Right. And I use that as an example of it takes sometimes discomfort for us to rock the boat. Sometimes that level of discomfort is offending. Sometimes it's not right. Sometimes it is right. But like I said, you know, everybody's right. We just have to do something to shake the boat. Like I said, our society is moving in a bad direction, and anything we can do, good or bad, to change it right now, it's kind of maybe can lead to some change.
Yeah, the rock the boat part of trying to bring us together. I think it was Hurricane Matthew. I did an overnight podcast when Hurricane Matthew came by, and I was talking about how tragedy brings communities together. Right now, and some. Lately, you saw come together. The Keys, I know, may be coming together now, but the first couple days in the Keys, it was terrible, man.
Oh no, what they are completely forgotten in all of this. The Keys
those first couple of days, local people were raiding houses. It was some the purge type shit down there, man. And you know, all this crazy stuff was happening. Now Houston, for a while I was really impressed with, and still am.
Yes,
I didn't see any I was really like, holy shit, Houston was holding it down. Mm-hmm. You know, everyone helping. You didn't hear about looting anything after Irma came through. It wasn't a day or two. I heard Miami looting, and I had gotten
it was happening while it was going on.
Yeah, while it was going on, and I said, man, I remember talking over Matthew about the topic of saying, you know, why does it take tragedy to pull us together? And then even when it does, how long do we hold on to that before we discard it? And then we're now down the road of desensitization or being desensitized. And that's why I thought about this one and even polls. Mm-hmm. It felt like it divided us even further rather than pulled us together.
I think the one thing that I took from Hurricane Irma and Harvey, for that matter, is that we are not ready for an apocalypse or nuclear war.
We're not ready for three hurricanes.
Yeah,
two.
We were out of power for a couple of days, and people were losing it.
Yeah, I had tons of friends. I had friends with dogs at the house. People come. You know, we had running water. Thank God. But I mean, when I thought about the Keys, down there and Puerto Rico, all the other islands,
we are one event away from reverting back to our animalistic tendencies.
Dude,
we like to say that we're civilized and humanistic, but let me tell you what the best can come out in people. But definitely I don't want to say the worst, but the animalistic basic human survival will come out in people as well.
Well, yeah. I mean, the email that I got was pretty detailed about what was happening in the Keys, the Southern Keys, with the flooding of seaweed, stuff everywhere, septic in places, standing salt water, right, washout, wet boards, heat, the bugs, etc. When you walk in that, and when you really live in that, and it's 3, 4, 5, 2 weeks, and food is scarce, water is scarce, right? You're waterlogged. Mm-hmm. Who knows the sicknesses, diseases that you may be experiencing from the water that's around. I don't think people can really fathom what that's really like. They're just a little ticker on the news screen. Yeah. They're an update at 6:30, on the local news. Until, right, that happens to you. Mm-hmm. And even now, Harvey was, I thought, they really pulled a great example, gave kind of hope. And then watching this stupid personal shit between our government and Puerto Rico, right? Mm-hmm. And small thing, and hopefully this doesn't blow up too much to more of a break. It just seems like it's beginning to cause more rifts than really it's bringing us together. It's making us really it's making us pick teams. We're finally going, okay, I'm on that team.
Yeah.
It's almost dividing the two. Okay, you're over there, fine.
And not because you really agree with it, but because you don't want to be identified as this other team. So it's like, I don't want to be on this team, but I definitely don't want to be seen as being on that one.
Yeah. And then when something like this happens, it makes a more personal drive into that decision, right? Then that may be that push for them. Well, I don't agree with all this, but, you know, something like this, this is too much. And then that fear, we respond and then pick the team and riot and yell irrational solutions at tragedies and say, we'll stop all tragedies. It's scary as shit, man. It's hard really not to think apocalyptically. I'm going to make that word up. You know, and when you really look at that stuff, it's hard not to. But what do you do? You know, they've been saying it since 1908. They've been saying it since there was a form of something all the time. But it now it's hard not to look at the science. For me, I look at outbreaks, right? The idea of some sort of crazy flu or something that breaks out from places where certain handling of meats or something.
You're afraid of that, aren't you?
No, I think that's going to be the end of it. I'm not going to see it. You know, I don't know. I hope I don't see it. But it's things like that where you really look at science, though, and go, well, it's fucking making shit disgusting, right? Where water dumps off, sludge left over from coal mines. When you really see that kind of shit, you do say, well, I'm sure I might not see that day when it doesn't there. But I do fear for, you know, what my daughter's future is like. When it's shooters like this that are domestic and born and raised here that snap, whether it's a mental health issue or dementia. I mean, how long? Play it out. What are the averages, right? As a psychologist, we look at the past. So let's look at the country as we wrap this up, right? I bring the country of the United States to you for a diagnosis as a person. And let's use the last, 50 years of its history. Give me a diagnosis of our country today as a whole.
Post-traumatic stress disorder.
Walk over the symptoms and criterion, and let me link this to how we're looking at the country.
Well, one is it's avoidance. It's hypersensitivity to the perceived or real trauma. You know, there's... it's hard to kind of attribute that to an actual country versus a person, but things like making decisions based off of that fear, in a person, it can be anything from sleep disturbances, anxiety, worry.
All on the rise.
All on the rise, anger. And I think we only have to look to 9/11. You know, look at what happened during September 11th. We overnight were traumatized, and ever since then, all of our decisions in this country have basically been based off of something like that. Policies change, security change.
But Doc, look, my name's the United States. Doc, you don't understand. You weren't there. We had to bring freedom. They may have had nuclear weapons. We needed some oil. You know, we had to go in there. They hit our buildings. Maybe we had something to do with it. Maybe we didn't. Maybe it is. Maybe we don't. Maybe we can prove it. That's not the point. The point it happened. It still traumatized the people that had the experience. So I don't even want to walk down that, But this was my life, man. There were things going on around the world that were affecting my decisions. You know, I had to drop some bombs over here, a little bit over here. But we're bringing democracy 25 years later, you're right, 17 years later to the same places, you know, forever. But I'm doing all right, right?
Is that really what you think you did?
As the, you know, well, yeah, in the United States. Yeah, that's we did it for freedom and for democracy.
Well, it came
and,
out of fear. It wasn't about democracy or freedom. It was about fear. And it was probably a fear of losing freedom. But that's exactly what we did for ourselves. We took away our own freedom out of fear.
Yeah. I hate taking my shoes off at the fucking airport.
No, we used to, you know, before then, we never thought about
people. It's very unsanitary. Yeah. I'm just
it's pretty
saying.
Dirty.
What? Yeah. Feet from around the world that have walked on God knows what, walk right there.
Well, let me ask you this. What are you afraid of by taking your shoes off?
I don't want to die from the inside out from the disease. Because look, man, I'm terrified because all these years of podcasting, right? I've walked through, I know the lack of antibiotics. I know the rise of the superbugs that are untreatable. I know we're killing the rainforest, which most of our antibiotics come from. I've been poured in. It's too
Lord,
much.
Man, you are so afraid.
No, I already know the end. I'm afraid if I don't know what's going to happen, right? So I already know how this shit goes
down. Once the end happens, what happens after the end?
Yeah, that's, and actually I've been a lot more excited about that than I ever have been lately. Because if you can play with it, right? For one, what if it's whatever you believe it is? Mm-hmm. Well, fuck. The other side's left open to some awesomeness, right? What if you try to live for 5 minutes with the thought that it never ends, you just get another go-round. Your toes will be different, right? You won't even know it's the next go-round, but if you know now, it's just another go-round. Mm-hmm. Is it that serious that if, oh, you got tapped out, or is it more like Pac-Man, right, where damn, you lost a life, you got another one, right? Yeah. If that thought was real, how do you live then tomorrow, right, where it's more fun, you kind of relax, it's not this, hey, I'm going out with a bang idea, right, because it's the only one, you got to repopulate based on it, right?
Right.
So even the thoughts about that of focusing on, I don't know, a gravity problem, something you could really change. But I try to be a little more optimistic, I think. But yeah. I can't be too positive because that's irrational.
That's right. We don't believe in positive thinking.
No, but I'm a fucking romantic, though.
That's you're a realist.
Yeah, a rational romantic.
Yeah, you're a real Shakespeare, like I said.
The realist shit bothers me, too, when people are like, I'm a realist. I'm like, you mean you believe your perception to be truth and the only reality that would you call reality, so thus you're a realist? We can't have a conversation. If we can't get by that already, we're going to fight each other. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
I describe realistic thinking as based in fact and objective thought.
Yeah, yeah.
The free best from positive, free from negative influence, just descriptive.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, even the descriptive, right? If you're like, that's a good steak right there, right? Well, to some people, they want the Pittsburgh, some want a Chicago style.
Well, now you're using a thought distortion of good and bad.
All right.
You're labeling.
Jesus.
Man, it's been a while since I've been here. You need my help.
I know. If we skip too many podcasts, you see where I start drifting off.
Yeah.
Well, let's see here, Doc. I've dealt with Harvey. I dealt with Irma, right? No. I mean, but we want to connect to it, right? You find ourselves wanting to connect. Where does that play a role too, right? Where we feel like, I thought the other you diagnosed in the United States was going to be it, but that, the last one, we're really wrapping up on this one. The role playing where we feel like we want to be connected to the story of the our now, which is happening. And social media gives us this rational idea that we are tapped into the stream of what's happening and we just want to be a part of it because we want to be always in our life, right? We want to know what's happening because we could die tomorrow. So I'm up to date. I'm Twitter and I'm there. We see that as being a part of the whole entwined system.
Mm-hmm.
Could that be a part of why we want to attach ourselves to tragedies, to the comebacks, to the stories? We identify with the main things you see on social media.
Well, I think we have a limited ability to do that through social media. You know, unless we have a more personal, you know, unless it changes our life in some ways that, you know, you have a loved one die, your life will never be the same because that loved one isn't there anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah, we can scroll through a social media page and be sad. Maybe we'll even shed tears. But then we turn the phone off and we go about our day. And it doesn't really change who we are. It doesn't really change our behavior unless we take this strategy and use it to change ourselves personally, to try and be a better person, to try and move on and live a life free from fear, but also being a different and better person in all we do. Because we didn't lose loved ones. We weren't there to see it. We weren't there to experience it. We don't have that personalized connection. So I think the best you can do is try and move on and keep those people in your thoughts, prayers, whatever, and use it to elicit personal change within yourself.
Yeah. Make the change. I had a really good closing question. And I started listening to you too much. And then the question left. I'm trying to keep the question, pay attention. I'm like, now if you get me in your little cognitive rampage, brother. And the backcountry doctor rampage at the end. It's true. Being able to affect proximity is really where we can make that change and being rational about what we can affect, what we can change. And to just, I guess, keep going, right? To keep doing maybe not what we do, but not being afraid.
Yeah,
you know, being aware of the fear, how it motivates us, right, or pushes us to change things maybe we don't want to change.
Yeah, no, change is uncomfortable. Change is difficult. I tell tell everybody that the number one reason people come to see me is not because of depression, anxiety, or relationship problems or substances, although that's usually what we talk about, but it's change. Either something has changed in their life
that
has made them uncomfortable, or they have trouble adapting to, or they're in a position and they want to change and they don't know how.
I held on to it the whole time. If you woke up tomorrow with an endless budget to apply toward mental health help, however that could work, right? I mean, you, let's say you could rip up the system from the carpet, from the base, right? You can pull the foundation, but just in the applied mental health part, however this goes, endless budget, this isn't the discussion. What do we do to really affect change in what we really offer for mental health on all aspects? Even just an umbrella approach is good.
All right. I would say put more money into paying the doctors.
So you're going to pay them more. But they're peddling the drugs, though. Well, they're the ones peddling the perpetuating the system.
Psychologists, therapists, those who provide the therapy and mental health services. And the reason why I say that is, for one, if you put more money in there, they can take more people. You know, they can, you know, if you help those who can't afford, because the people who have insurance can afford insurance to go. Those who are severely mentally ill, they can't hold a job. They can't pay for insurance. So they fall in between the cracks. They end up in community mental health centers, which if you've ever been to, you've worked in one, I've worked in one. They can be very, I'm trying to think of a right word. They're difficult places to be, and you don't get the best of services. God bless those people who work there. They try their hardest to do the best they can with the funding they have, and they were way underpaid. So if you fund these people, you pay the therapist more, you pay the doctors more, they can see more of these people because they don't have to go out and just look for private pay or certain people who are have the ability to pay. They can make a living seeing everybody. If you get paid well for seeing everybody, more psychologists and more therapists will flock to this field and then increase the ability to even see more people. So I would say paying the mental health professionals more money is a good way of doing it. It would make that there'd be a lot more of them. There'd be a lot more access to them. And everybody would be able to see them. Of course, you know, that would be, you know, aside from, you know, you take this money and you put it toward people who can't afford insurance, or you could, you know, supplement it. And also, you know, people who can't afford insurance don't have to use it. Because it, as you know, the game of mental health insurance or in health insurance in general, really works against doctors in some ways too.
Well, when you see them, at first glance, people go, well, like I did, right? We're putting more into the broken system. And I agree with you that if we put it more toward the private practitioners, away from the hospital settings, and move in toward, for myself, the actually into their environment, right? Even get the practitioners out of the offices and into those people's lives, into their homes, which is more expensive, right? Because you got to be safe. You got to make sure you got enough people. Can't just send one. So it ends up being more expensive. But over time, you may actually make real change in an expensive short time than no change, worse change over a long time.
No, you know, putting funding into that would, you know, they wouldn't, doctors, mental health professionals, they would not be controlled by the insurance companies. So instead of spending an hour on paperwork, they could spend that hour helping somebody.
Well, and I fucking love how you see all the politicians now run on more money for mental health, right? They all run on it. And they put all this money toward, I even wrote a letter, you know, that whole blog response, right? 300 something billion, I think, for mental health. Like, it's a broken system. You're put in the wrong places, right? It just sounds good. And all this clamor for mental health and help, they just dump money down it. But recently, they cut pay. So they're paying psychologists and mental health counselors less. The insurance company controls who sees them and who really does. Now, most of them go to self-pay now. So if I want to see somebody, I have a private practice of a caliber that can work, right, that's up to date, you know, $150 a week on average to $250.
People can't afford that.
Yeah, once a week for, you know.
They might be able to afford that once a month. Right. And they don't, you know, they need to be seen weekly. They come once a month. What can you do for somebody? You do the best you can with that 1 hour that you see them, but you know that they need more, and they know that they need more.
Yeah. That's the insurance-based care bullshit. Right.
And I think when people don't get counseling, who need counseling, that's oftentimes when they end up in places like community mental health centers, where they have a psychiatrist dishing out medications that are state funded.
And let's say
and then you get
on the 32nd floor of Vegas, right? In the nightclubs of Pulse.
Yeah, it's yeah. Very possible.
Yeah,
very
possible. You get that, you know?
Run, you know, driving a car through a crowd.
That's right. That's where you get that. But look, so far, if we've
taken... self-medicating throughout, you know, drugs and alcohol.
Yeah, let's take in two suggestions and solutions toward what we put here, which is teach the psychology at a young level to the mm-hmm. kids, teach them the tools, experiences. We're not giving up freedoms there. We're educating on the back end. And by helping to change there, and then for the people that do need to change it at an older place, is get more people to be practitioners. Because look, you're going to make 38 grand a year working for a facility.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. Then you
get not real appetizing.
No, and yeah. Then you get into it trying to do a private practice, dealing with insurance companies, and trying to own. It's just yeah. It's terrible. But make it to where people want to come help. Hell, I'm for, if you're in the helping profession, doctors, mental health counselors, social workers, you shouldn't pay for college. Mm-hmm. You still got to make the fucking grade. Most mm-hmm. people are like, oh, free college. You still got to pass. You know what I mean? So if right. you pass, that means you want to be it. I mean, when we wanted to change medical care, man, they sure swapped the route to be nurses pretty quick. Mm-hmm. You could take a few of these courses. The next thing you know, you're sure. working in an ER. I mean, not that you want to do that with mental health. My point is they make shit like that happen.
Right.
And when you put the money toward those people, just those two solutions, mm-hmm. You've taken no freedom.
Right.
You've given more access and money, but a little bit of money to pay some practitioners, you can find that.
Yes.
You know, those are
two
solutions.
You have to attract people to the area. You have to attract people to the field. And right now, the mental health field is not attractive.
Fuck no. No.
You left. Well, a lot of people left.
Yeah.
A lot of people, you know.
I do it from the outside now.
A lot of people who've been in this field for many, many, many years strongly feel like private practice is dying and it's not going to survive.
I've seen it. Yeah. Yeah, when I was just down in Naples, I watched some of the best at private practice
mm-hmm.
close up and move to dual diagnosis, right?
Yeah.
And then all the dual diagnosis facilities are monopolized. They're owned by one or two companies, so they can make sure. They can pay you $17 an hour with a master's degree mm-hmm. to deal with some of the toughest shit day to day, today, today. I mean, it's diminished. Just those two solutions, though, you know, teaching the kids.
I think it would make
young.
A big difference.
Yeah.
It really would. I think the service would be there. I think it would help the general population, and it would help those who are helping the general population.
So instead now, when people are scrolling social media over these tragedies and they're seeing the talk of mental health awareness, these are two solutions that, you know, hopefully politicians, people can start talking about going, look, real change, you know, from someone in the field, somebody in and out of the field, right?
Mm-hmm.
Seeing from the outside and the inside. Two solutions that don't infringe on people's freedoms. We're not talking about amendments or changing constitutions or doing a big giant gun collection every Sunday,
yeah.
Right? These are rational approaches.
You know, I hate to use averages after we just bash the averages,
yeah.
But most of the research out there does show that only 1-2% of the cost of healthcare is mental health. Yet it's only 1-2%, but that's where most of the cuts are being made in order to save money by insurance companies.
Well, you stop taking care of yourself, period, mm-hmm. when the choices that bring on predispositions, medical predispositions, and our behavior, it makes us either not be healthy, mm-hmm. Do poor choice behaviors. Well, that medical shit that's spending all that money, that could be starting at a mental health issue.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, they need to put more emphasis on it. And I think I once went to a seminar with a wonderful neuropsychologist.
We just can't feed the same system, right? We just can't say – for me, it's private practice for sure. Because for me, I would say I want access to everything, whether it's ayahuasca or anything else. I mean, if it's on the menu and you're down – because if you're talking about suicide, brother, then it's all on the table.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you open up everything. Then you get all the quirky little shops trying to help. And when it comes to mental health, some shit is not scientific based, but the placebo effect is crazy.
Huh.
You know, if somebody's willing to, you know.
Well, you know, I mean, sometimes what works. Generally in mental health, you know, the treatments have to be empirically validated.
Right.
You know, there's some very, very good science. And I mean, the science is good enough to show that long-term results, psychotherapy works better than medication long-term.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it is statistically. But now
you got half an hour times. That's all the time, right? So people are getting cut to shorter times.
They're it's cutting
too expensive.
Times.
I'm with the traditional. Mm-hmm. As long as the tradition doesn't go right to the pills right away, because most psychologists don't. Yeah. You know, they stay within the realms.
And if we focus on mental health, like I was about to say about the neuropsychologist, who also had an MD, very impressive guy. He showed how if we focused more on mental health to work more toward depression, then it would reduce a great deal of heart disease to save millions of dollars in this country. That one of the number one factors of heart disease, is depression.
Yeah, sure. I mean, we biological links directly.
I mean, the amount of money that we could save on the medical side, let alone lives we could You know, of course, they're thinking money. The amount of money they could save by focusing on mental health makes you question why they're not doing it.
Because what's the response? Well, who's paying for it? Right. That's the Republican. Look, if your response to most things is who's paying for it, you're probably an asshole.
Mm-hmm.
Because somebody's talking about trying to help and save people. And if your response is trying to save lives, who's going to pay for it? Well, you're probably an asshole.
Yeah.
You know, so, and for this saves money. So we're proving it saves does. Money to put it. And it's the time, right? Imagine that.
Not only does it save money, but it saves lives.
Right.
But imagine it should be more important than anything.
Yeah. Forget the overhead as a counselor, right? Or a psychologist. Forget the business, the computer programs to pay the insurance people, the forget the one person up front to help you, but forget that. You're daily going in people's lives, visiting their house, going with them to work, right? Getting an honest urge or wage for what that is really worth and what it entails, enough to where you can afford help for yourself, right? So we don't get to what we talked about in the beginning, right? Getting disillusioned and getting numb to it. And so everyone can utilize and grow from that, man. And I'm with you. I love the fact that it's still two solutions that are easily implemented.
Very too. Education and
tell me a party if you can't get behind those two fucking solutions. They have nothing to do with guns, all right? And we're not going to take everyone's freedom and give them a butt search mental health check and check them off as sane or not, right? Because that's not fucking rational either.
No, and since you know mental health is only 1-2% of the cost, I mean it's not going to be a big thing to bump it to like 4%.
Yeah,
I mean that would double everything.
Well, we'd lose 100 missiles that year. We have to make.
Oh, that's
right. That's the argument. It's a real argument. Yeah. That's not what it sounds like. But I mean, these are solutions, man. And I think if more people like yourself find ways and bullhorns to get behind and say those small solutions, going, look, you don't have to believe in guns or not to actually have a talk of solutions that can do something. Do you believe in educating your kids so he doesn't get depressed or she doesn't get anxiety? Hell yeah. Mm-hmm. I think both sides can get agree with that, you know?
And it solves a problem. It's not just taking away the guns, because taking away guns is the same thing as slapping a Band-Aid on.
Yeah.
You know, it's not healing the cut. It's not fixing the problem where actually
just taking the phone from the kid doesn't teach them anything. Teach them how to be – not to use it while they have it, the self-control and discipline, right?
Right.
Is that kind of where you're leaning?
Yeah. I mean it's not solving the problem.
Yeah.
And I think this is something that would start early. It's preventative medicine. And then if something does come about, it's a better quality of and more mental health professionals.
We probably lost half the viewers once we had a solution require a team. Once it became we didn't require a team or a gun choice or taking freedom away for personal ID checks.
We've had like two encores and an additional question. I'm not even sure what we it's been so long since we've seen each other to hang out that we've made up for probably a year of podcasting.
Well, that's going to change now that you're literally 15 minutes from the house now that I'm back home.
Yeah, I'm excited that you're here, man. It's you went off and had a spiritual journey out west. And,
again, it's funny. The first book stemmed from a spiritual journey out west. I finished the second book while I was on the second journey out west.
Yeah,
I wrapped it up in April when I was actually out in Sedona. That's when I wrapped it up. So I did not plan that shit. It looks weird, but I'm like, I didn't. I finished both books, or both. One inspired from the trip to the desert, wrote that one. This one was finished in the desert. I was literally a couple hours from Gallup, New Mexico, that I wrote about. Mm-hmm. And it was fucking tripping, nice. Man. But it's good to be back, man.
Good.
You're down.
It's good to have you back.
You agree to take, where we're going fishing soon, right?
We're going to go fishing, and we're going to do more of these podcasts. And we can get, we'll have to come up with some creative ideas that people would like.
All right. Oh, we'll have fun with that. I got to get drag Eric's ass back in here. I'm trying to threaten him with airing the second episode, the very drunk Eric episode of us. That was episode two ever. Number two of the whole podcast.
It was part of what started it all.
Eric didn't give a shit, though. He's like, fuck, I'd play it. I was like, damn, I can't blackmail him anymore. But we'll do it again. Now you're down the road, man. I appreciate you coming.
All right, man. Love you, brother.
Love you as always, man.
All right, bro. I'll be fishing tomorrow.